Deliver today's keynote address, I am pleased to welcome the RBA's Assistant Governor, Christopher Kent. Christopher is responsible for the oversight of the RBA's operations in the domestic and global financial markets, including the management of Australia's foreign reserves. Prior to this role, he was the central bank's chief economist, and today he is going to talk to us about the financial conditions in Australia. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Kent. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for that kind introduction. And I wanted to thank the Australian Banking Association for inviting me to this conference today. On the occasion this year of the ABA's 70th anniversary, it'd be very tempting, especially someone who likes banking history, to look back over the history of that in Australia. But instead, I'm going to focus on things in the here and now in terms of financial conditions. I know that's of interest to many of you, if not all of you in the room, and indeed to Australians more generally. The tightening in monetary policy over the past 2 years is underpinning restrictive financial conditions in Australia. This is contributing to slower growth of aggregate demand, and that's helping to bring down the level of demand to be in better balance with supply and lower inflation. While the recent economic data have been mixed, they have reinforced, though, the need to remain vigilant to the upside risk to inflation. And hence, with regards to the path of interest rates, which remains uncertain, the Reserve Bank Board is not ruling anything in or out. Financial conditions are particularly restrictive for households, but less so for larger businesses. Higher interest rates, they work through several channels, and their effects are going to vary across different households and businesses according to their own circumstances, including their level of indebtedness and the shape of their balance sheets more broadly. So monetary policy is the key determinant of financial conditions for households and businesses. And since May of 2022, the RBA has raised the cash rate by 425 basis points. We know that many are feeling a painful squeeze on their finances because of those higher interest rates. High inflation, though, has also reduced people's purchasing power, and it's adversely affected all households, though especially those on lower incomes. One way to gauge the stance of monetary policy is to compare the cash rate, shown here in orange, with estimates of the nominal neutral interest rate. Now, definitions of the neutral rate vary, but in essence, it's the level of the cash rate that would neither stimulate nor restrain demand. In other words, it would underpin a balance between demand and supply of goods and services and in the labour market, with inflation consistent with the target. And currently, as you can see here, the cash rate is above our range of estimates of the nominal neutral rate. And that followed a period before and during the pandemic when it was below neutral, when monetary policy was stimulating the economy. The cash rate is also above most estimates of the nominal neutral rate that are provided to us by market economists, surveyed by the bank. In May, the median estimate among market economists implied the cash rate was around 1 percentage point above the nominal neutral rate. So in short, these estimates imply that monetary policy is restrictive, and so it's continuing to bring aggregate demand into better balance with supply, and that's as intended. That said, estimates of the neutral rate are subject to considerable uncertainty. So the extent to which its monetary policy is restrictive is not entirely clear. Also, the neutral rate, as you can see here, that can change over time. Indeed, our estimates for Australia have increased since the pandemic, and that's true also for other economies. Factors often cited as drivers for the recent increase in the neutral rate include increases in public debt globally, downward pressure on savings due to demographic changes, such as that baby boomer generation moving right into retirement, and increases in investment from both the public sector, private sectors, including to support the transition, the green energy transition. Now, there's also many methodological and conceptual choices involved in estimating the neutral rate. And as my former colleague Lucy Ellis put it, estimates of the neutral rate at best cast a faint light to guide monetary policymakers. So there's a lot in here, but we can also assess financial conditions by examining a broad set of indicators that complement the signals we take from the real economy. And that's what I've done here with this dashboard of selected indicators. And what they do, and I'll step through it carefully, is they point to financial conditions being restrictive. This is most obvious for the benchmark measures of interest rates and for financial conditions faced by households. Conditions appear to be less tight for larger businesses. So as I said, there's a lot here. I'll step through it carefully. The scale on each row, the numbers on the left and the right, that corresponds to the range of these measures since the global financial crisis. The grey shaded area, that shows the typical range of outcomes. The blue dots, those are the most recent value for each measure. Further, the dot is to the right of the chart, the tighter are financial conditions along that dimension, and the further to the left, the looser are conditions. And then the green dots are the averages. So we need to be a bit careful though, because just like the neutral level of an indicator, that can rise or decline over time for various reasons, just like the neutral rate can move around. So a deviation from the average of the sample might not give a true measure of the degree of tightness right now. For example, the measure of required mortgage payments as a share of household disposable income is at its highest since the GFC, but total household debt payments are not. And that difference reflects a downtrend, which I'll come to later, in personal credit over the period. So the two measures shown at the top of the dashboard, they're key interest rate benchmarks. They're currently higher than the historical averages. As mentioned earlier, the cash rate target's been raised by 425 basis points of late. The three-year government bond yield, the AGS yield, is a bit below the level of the cash rate, but it's still quite a bit higher than its post-GFC average. The middle four measures, they relate to financial conditions faced by households, and they're quite tight. And finally, the bottom five measures show financial conditions faced by businesses, and these are less tight than they are for households. So overall, financial conditions are restrictive for households. While higher interest rates affect the decisions of all households, the effects of tighter monetary policy are felt most keenly and directly by roughly 40% of Australian households that have a mortgage. The average rate on outstanding mortgages has risen by about 335 basis points over the tightening phase to date, so that's to a little over 6%. Pass-through from the cash rate has been a bit less than in the past because a high share of mortgages, as we heard earlier, were fixed at low rates during the pandemic. Increased discounting on mortgages by lenders competing for good quality borrowers, that's also played a role. Nevertheless, the increase in mortgage rates has been large, it's been rapid. Also, most of the remaining fixed rate loans from the pandemic era will expire over the rest of this year, and that's going to add about 20 basis points to the average outstanding mortgage rate shown here. So while mortgage rates are below the peak in 2007, households hold a bit more mortgage debt, at least as a share of their disposable income since then. As a result, scheduled mortgage payments, which include mortgage principal as well as interest, they've increased to around 10% of household disposable income. So that's shown by the blue bars in this chart. Our estimate suggests the total scheduled debt payments, so that includes payments on consumer credit, they've also increased, and those are shown by the top of the green bars. But total scheduled debt payments by households remain below their earlier peaks because the stock of consumer credit has declined significantly since 2008, and I'll come back to that later. Meanwhile, extra payments into mortgage and offset and redraw accounts, we heard about those just in the previous session, they're shown in grey here, they've held up despite households having to pay higher scheduled debt payments. So I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. That rise in scheduled debt payments, what households really have to pay on their mortgages and their consumer debt, that's put additional pressure on the budgets of many households, and that's contributed to weakness in consumption growth. And while many indebted households, and particularly those on lower incomes, have felt these budget pressures acutely, nearly all borrowers are servicing their debts on schedule. Much of that reflects the resilience in the labour market. So even though conditions there are gradually easing, they remain tight. The share also of credit card balances accruing interests, that remains low. And that suggests to us that most households are responding to these cost of living pressures via some combination of consuming less or saving less than in the past. They're not running up their credit card debt. And growth in employment, that's also supported some households' ability to service their debts. Now, higher interest rates are providing an incentive for all households to save more and to borrow less. For households with a mortgage, despite higher debt servicing costs and other pressures on disposable incomes, payments into offset and redraw accounts, they've increased as a share of income over recent quarters, and you can see that in the bottom panel of this chart. Flows of these extra payments are actually now a little bit above their pre-pandemic average. And by contrast, if you look in the top panel, the gross savings rate across all households, that's declined. It's now a bit below its pre-pandemic average. So look, the different behaviour between these two series reflects a combination of things, including differences in measurement approaches and economic factors. But one such factor is that households with a mortgage face a strong incentive to keep their savings in offset and redraw accounts because they earn a high tax-adjusted rate of return when interest rates are high. High interest rates also provide an incentive for households without debt to save more than they would otherwise. And while the savings rate of the household sector has declined, higher interest rates are still likely to be influencing their savings decisions. Indeed, households facing a range of pressures on their disposable incomes are responding by restraining their consumption of discretionary items and saving less. However, households overall are still saving. Moreover, both households with a mortgage overall and the broader household sector as a whole still have substantial stocks of additional savings that were built up during the pandemic. Now, as we heard before and Andrew suggested, that's not true, of course, for all households, right? With many having run down savings to support consumption in the face of significant budgetary pressures. As expected, higher interest rates have weighed on household credit growth. That's shown here in the top panel. While household credit growth has picked up a little since early 2023, alongside rising house prices, it remains a little bit below average, as shown by the dashed line. And after we deduct off offset balances, household credit growth has actually been flat for the past year or so. Moreover, the level of household credit has declined as a share of household disposable income, and that's shown in the bottom panel. The decline in this measure of household indebtedness is apparent in several other indicators. Actually, yeah, so just to cite a couple of those, average loan to value ratios for new loans have declined over this phase of monetary policy tightening. Also, loan discharges from property sales have increased, as you can see on the right-hand side, and they've increased by more than the rise in new lendings, which is shown as commitments in this chart. So I think what these data tell me is that these trends are likely to reflect incentives to reduce or at least limit indebtedness in response to higher rates. So what about businesses? Well, increases in the cash rate have flowed through to higher business lending rates and higher corporate bond yields, although pass-through has varied across different markets. Average rates on large business loans have increased by more than 425 basis points over the tightening phase, compared with around 310 for small businesses. However, small businesses continue to face substantially higher interest rates than their medium and large counterparts, as you can see here. Large businesses with access to wholesale funding markets have also benefited from favourable conditions in those markets. In particular, corporate bond yields have risen, but by less than the rise in the risk-free yields over the tightening phase, because credit spreads have narrowed quite noticeably. Despite the rise in the cost of new business debt, the growth of that debt remains above the post-GFC average. And that reflects business credit growth remaining above average, as well as strong issuance of corporate bonds by large companies over the past year or so. Above average growth of business debt, that's been supported by relatively strong growth in business investment, although business investment has slowed more recently, and some businesses have curtailed the investment plans a little in response to cost pressures and the weakness in aggregate demand, and businesses expect the pace of investment growth to slow further in the year ahead. As has been the case for many years, small business lending has not grown over the past year or so, and small businesses report that accessing funding through banks with terms that suit their needs remains a significant challenge. For many medium and large businesses, the effect of higher interest rates has been partly offset by strong nominal earnings, relatively low leverage, and in some cases, debt that was issued much earlier at low fixed rates. Indeed, the median interest coverage ratio of listed companies has declined over the tightening phase, but it's around its post-GFC average, partly reflecting a longer-term decline in gearing. Aggregate leverage of non-financial businesses remains relatively low at a little over 20%, which is below the pre-pandemic average of nearly 30%. So all else equal, this decline in leverage would suggest that monetary policy is having less effect on the average business. Most listed companies also hold cash buffers that are slightly higher than pre-pandemic levels, and many businesses have been in a strong financial position throughout the tightening phase. These trends are likely to have contributed to businesses continuing to borrow at an above average pace despite these higher interest rates. Among smaller businesses, aggregate cash buffers remain above historical averages, but there's quite a lot of variation across those. And they have declined over the past year. Information from our RBA liaison program suggests that liquidity buffers are quite unevenly distributed. Tighter financial conditions are likely to have had a stronger effect on businesses with higher pre-existing leverage and generally weaker balance sheets, as well as smaller businesses which don't have access to wholesale funding markets. Indicators of business financial stress generally remain low, but some businesses are experiencing challenging conditions. And the share of businesses entering insolvency has increased since early 2022, as shown in this chart. So that's particularly true for businesses in the construction and hospitality sectors, although this follows a period of very low insolvencies owing to pandemic-related support measures. Most of the firms entering insolvencies are small businesses, albeit with little debt, and so rates of non-performing loans have increased slightly, but they remain pretty low by historical standards. So in conclusion, if we look across a range of measures, they show that monetary policy tightening has led to restrictive financial conditions. However, the extent of that varies across different sectors and also within sectors. Households have been responding to higher interest rates, and while households with mortgages are significantly affected, and quite directly, consumption growth is weak for most people. Smaller businesses, businesses with higher leverage, they're also facing financial pressures, much more so than many larger businesses. But notwithstanding these differences, restrictive financial conditions are helping to slow the growth of aggregate demand, thereby bringing the level of that demand into better balance with supply, and that's contributing to a decline in inflation, which is to the benefit of all Australian households and businesses. And with that, let me finish, and I'm open to questions.
How about a round of applause? Thank you, Christopher.
We do have our microphones in the room. Throw your hands in the air if you'd like to ask a question of the Assistant Governor of the Reserve Bank. Quick question for you, Christopher. You probably don't get a chance to talk about interest rates all that often these days. It's fascinating. Anna referred to the higher than normal interest rates. For some newer borrowers, these are the highest rates they've ever encountered. Mm-hmm. While you've got boomers sitting in the paid-off house going, dude, 17%, you know, call me when it gets there. That neutral interest rate, it looked like it's somewhere between sort of 3.5, 3.7. What is the neutral rate and what conditions the RBA need before we move out of restrictive back to neutral?
I didn't put a number in my speech because I want to emphasise the uncertainty. Yeah, if you eyeball the graph, it's a bit above 3.5. What do we need to see, though? I think what we're looking for inflation to move towards target in a sustainable fashion. So we want to see evidence of further fall in underlying inflationary pressures. The data of late, though, have been quite mixed. They've reinforced, in fact, the need to be alert to upside risk to inflation. And so with regards to the interest rate path, the board really has said they're not ruling anything in or out.
We've got a question there. What would you like to ask?
Looking outside of the banking sector, can you see any risks emerging from the private credit sector in particular and spilling over into the main financial system?
It's pretty weird when it just comes out of the light.
Yes,
like that,
right out of the light.
Something in the ether
talking
to us.
Look, I think private credits, performs an important role in the market. It's something we watch carefully. We're not overly concerned because it's not especially large in Australia, but it's something we'll watch. Businesses, as I said, are still investing. It's quite a contrast between business confidence and business conditions and where the consumer feels, which is well below average. For businesses, it's much closer to average.
We've got another audience question. He's racing across the room. Have you got another one there, mate? No. Fantastic.
Oh, yes.
We'll take one question in the middle of the room here and then we'll wrap it up. Coming from behind you there, ma'am, what would you like to ask?
Lovely, thank you. Seeing the increase in the discharges, does that tell us that consumers are selling their house rather than participating in hardship processes with banks? And so I guess what can we do about that? But also, does it mean some of those other impacts around arrears and things are maybe underestimates of the true impact to some of our consumers?
All of that is possible. I think the thing I take from it is that in an environment of higher interest rates, I think what this tells me is those with more leverage are the ones more likely to be selling, which makes sense. The fact that the housing market is in a fairly healthy condition in terms of prices rising, that makes that job that much easier. So I think that's what's happening. Households are deleveraging. Now they're selling it to somebody else, but the somebody else has got less leverage. They're putting down a larger deposit. So that's the household sector as a whole deleveraging.
Final question from me, crypto. So Bitcoin's just halved again, seems to be holding up fairly well. Ether at record highs, but if I really want 100x, I probably need to speculate a bit. Christopher, when you dial up Robinhood at 3 a.m, having had a couple, where are you dropping a few lazy G's in crypto at the moment?
Well, I've long said that crypto's not an asset that I would play with. It's banned in my household for kids. That's gambling. We've pushed them, if they really do have spare cash, into the equity market instead. That's a different form of gambling. No, it's not an asset, and it's not a form of payment either. I doubt you could go buy a nice cappuccino with a spot of your crypto today.
Does the Reserve Bank keep an eye on how much money is in there, and is there any potential risk if that market went completely to pot in an instant?
No, because it's generally not backed up by leverage. So when people speculate on assets, the real concern is when they back it up with a lot of leverage or that forms an important source of collateral. As best I know, crypto isn't a good source of collateral.
Please a round of applause for Christopher Kent. Thanks, Christopher. Wonderful presentation.
Thanks,
mate. Great stuff.
Cheers, mate.
In farewell, and Christopher from the stage, I will note some of you will recall around this time...